south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 302, covering the week of March 21st through April 1st, 2022. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, like our Gab page, and subscribe to our YouTube page. Our YouTube page is an invaluable resource. It's where we put up, of course, this podcast goes there, but also all of our lectures. We're going to have more Abbeville U videos this year. We're going to be trying to put out some documentaries. So there's a lot that's going to be going on with our YouTube page. So make sure you get over there and subscribe to that YouTube page. And when you do, make sure that you like the material, comment on the material. That bumps it in the algorithm and gets more people seeing our stuff. And so that's really important. Also, our Twitter account, we're going to be more active on that one too. So get on over to Twitter. If you're not on Twitter, consider joining Twitter and then also liking our stuff on Twitter. Even though it's a very leftist site, so is Facebook, but even though it's very leftist, that is an avenue we have to try to get our material out there. Also, our summer school is coming up July 5th through 8th, 2022 at Seabrook Island, South Carolina. Information on that is now on our website. So you're going to want to head over to abbevilleinstitute.org. That's A-B-B-E-V-I-L-L-E. Institute.org. Give us an email address when you're there. We'll give you a free ebook, Exploring the Southern Tradition. It's a great book. And then, of course, you get our daily dose of Dixie. You get information about our upcoming webinars. You get information about our events. You get information about anything we're doing with these videos. I know you can. It seems like it's going to be a lot of stuff, but don't unsubscribe because this is the way we can keep in contact with you. So you will be getting information about the summer school in an email if you're on the email list. So make sure you do that. Also, if you like the podcast, you can subscribe, rate, review, and subscribe to that, right? So if you get your podcast at Apple Podcasts or Spotify, make sure you subscribe, make sure you rate and review the podcast, let people know you love it, and that way more people see it and listen to it. Also, click on that shop tab at abbevilleinstitute.org. Get our logo and all kinds of high-quality stuff. It's embroidered. It's really nice material, so consider doing that. There are all kinds of ways you can support the Institute. Go to Amazon Smile if you're an Amazon customer, and if you didn't know about this, but you can sign up to make the Abbeville Institute your preferred charity at Amazon Smile. We get a little bit of money out of that, so we're actually not doing too terrible with that now. People are using the Amazon Smile account to, every time they shop at Amazon, they give us a little change. So it's a great way to help support the Institute without doing anything else. It's painless. You're already shopping at Amazon. We get a few pennies out of it. And as always, you can donate. You can donate monthly, annually, or a one-time gift. We do exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you like the podcast, the website, the webinars, the conferences, the videos that we do, all the stuff we're trying to do behind the scenes, consider that tax-deductible donation to the full extent of the law. And we did have a great webinar this week with Michael Bolden of the 10th Amendment Center. We have another one coming up in the middle of April on the Jefferson Hemings myth. And I'll say that conclusively, the Jefferson Hemings myth. And that will be in the middle of April. Mark Andrew Holochak is going to be doing the webinar with us. So stay on the lookout for that through your email, right? So this is how we contact you. Don't unsubscribe from that email. It's important. It's the way that we can find you and keep in contact with you. Now, all that said, we didn't have a podcast last week. I got a little behind, didn't have a chance to do it. So we're going to cover 2 weeks sort of in this podcast in 30 minutes. I'm not going to make it any longer, but I want to start this week because it works with everything else, with the piece that we published on Thursday by John Devaney. And I say it works with everything else because it is the basis of what happens for the other things that we talk about. In fact, what we do at the Institute is to try to directly correct what's happened in the historical profession for the last half century. It goes back to the 1940s. It goes back to Kenneth Stamp. Now, this lecture by John Devaney in 2008, it was at our 2008 summer school. So we're talking about it was the fifth summer school. The first summer school was 2003, so it was our fifth summer school. We're up to almost 20 now, right? So we've had a lot since then. But this particular lecture sets the stage for what happens in the American historical profession with people like Kenneth Stamp, and people like Eric Foner, and there are others. But those are the two big names on the neo-abolitionist school of the historical profession. And there was a book written by a guy named Novick years ago entitled That Noble Dream. And what Novick did was go out and find Kenneth Stamp's correspondence. And if you look at his correspondence, it becomes very clear what Kenneth Stamp was. I talked about this in a lecture I delivered at a summer school a few years back on studying the New South. But Stamp is on record saying why he wrote what he did, because he didn't like the Randalls and the Cravens and all these dough faces, he called them, all these people that were, in his mind, racists who just simply wanted to portray the South in a positive light. What's really funny about that is neither Randall nor Craven were very kind to the South at times. They weren't very kind to the North, and I think this is the key to understanding this school of history, the blundering generation school that Craven and Randall are well known for. If you look at Avery Craven's The Coming of the Civil War, it's a great book. And he's not, he doesn't pull any punches with your side. Another historian like this is William Marvel, who wrote a nice multi-volume study of the war recently. The first volume of that series is Mr. Lincoln Goes to War, and it's fantastic. These books are popular history, but they're really good. And Marvel came out with a book not long ago, Lincoln's Mercenaries. And he built on a section of that first book that I think people were shocked by when Marvel went out and said, you know, let's follow the money here. Why are people getting involved in this war? It isn't to free the slaves. Not at all. In fact, it's for a paycheck. So how can this war be some type of moral crusade when nobody was really talking about that? There were a few abolitionists, of course. You could say, what about these abolitionists? There was a few. But the majority of America was not really concerned about the plight of slaves in the South or the future of slavery in the United States. What they really wanted was the slaves to stay out of the West. So what John Devaney does in this piece, it's fantastic. The speech, which has been transcribed and now up on the website. You can listen to the original, too. We have our lectures page. Also, our app. If you download our free mobile app, you can go out and get these lectures there, too. And they're on, if they're in video format, which we started doing in 2015, they're going to be on the YouTube. So you want to get that, too. But what Devaney does here is illustrate that this is all ideologically based. What these people are doing is coming in with an agenda, and their agenda is to make slavery the central focus of the war, and they're going to do everything they can, cherry-pick whatever they can, do whatever they can to prove that. And of course, Eric Foner is part of this. What he points out about Eric Foner, I think, is vital. I think he gets something wrong there when he's saying that John Hope Franklin was the basis for Foner. It wasn't. It was W.B. Du Bois. Foner writes about this in his book on Reconstruction. He says, look, when I was in high school, I did a review of W.E.B. Du Bois, and I said this is the key to Reconstruction. So what John Devaney says, I think, is so important. He says, look, this is essentially the view of Reconstruction from Black Americans. And it's not an unbiased history of Reconstruction. It's not a comprehensive story of Reconstruction because he leaves everything out. He leaves the other side out completely. If you really want a comprehensive story of Reconstruction, you know where you can get that? You can get it from the William Dunning School. You can get it from all those historians. Now, people would say, well, those guys are racist. They're all racist. But the thing is, when you look at Dunning and you look at all the different things they talked about, the documentary history of Reconstruction does have evidence in there from the Black perspective on Reconstruction. They didn't leave that stuff out. Yes, they were what we would call racist today. They certainly had a different view of Black Americans than most Americans today. But they also included all of this information in their studies. In fact, in some of these early stories of Reconstruction, you find a fairly sympathetic position on some of these things from the Dunning School. You do. But they're also sympathetic with white Southerners and what they were going through and the problems of Reconstruction from their perspective, too. So what you have in the Dunning School is actually a much more comprehensive view of Reconstruction than you get from Eric Foner or David Blight or any of these other morons that are out there writing this stuff. Because essentially what they're doing is pumping W.E.B. Du Bois. And when Du Bois produced his work on Reconstruction, it was It was actually very well received by the profession, except for some people like Craven, who wrote a scathing review of it when it first came out in the 1930s. I mean, he blasted this thing as being awful. And for good reason. It's not a very good story of Reconstruction. It's got its problems. It's not really based on any primary research. It's hearsay. It's a lot of things like that. Now, that doesn't mean oral tradition is not important. It is important. And there were some historians, again, who praised the book and said it's a valuable contribution to the story. But they understood it for what it was, which is a different voice for Reconstruction. You can't base a comprehensive book on Reconstruction on Du Bois. It's impossible to do it. It would be like saying we're only going to base it on these stories on one side of the story and not the other side. So if you want to have a comprehensive story, and this is what John Devaney points out in this particular lecture, if you want to have a comprehensive story of Reconstruction or a comprehensive story of the South, you cannot ignore the stuff that you don't like. And for the neo-abolitionists, anything that's written that they find to be troubling, if it's a racial view or a view of the general government or a positive view of the South, they're not going to consider it. In fact, they're going to pan it and consider it to be biased, and these people lied. That's the thing. They lied. That's really what it all comes down to. In these people's minds, Southerners, white Southerners, were lying during Reconstruction. It really wasn't as bad as they said. The South really wasn't as bad off as they said. The things that were happening really weren't happening. They were making this stuff up. All that they were worried about was somehow ensuring racial superiority. But when you look at what's actually happening and you look at some of the things that were going on in the South, it was downright awful. And so he even brings up Fogel and Engerman, whose time on the cross really changed the way people thought about slavery. The thing about Fogel and Engerman that everybody misses about that, and Devaney points this out, is that the book was actually written to promote a positive view of black Americans. Because what Fogel and Engerman wanted to do was say, well, look, you have this theory of slavery by, you know, very old theory of slavery, U.B. Phillips, who said that slaves were unproductive, it's because of their race, they're lazy. What Fogel and Engerman tried to do was say, well, this is not true at all. Slaves are actually very productive. They're more productive than white Southerners, in fact. They worked harder than white Southerners. So slaves were not these slugs who didn't want to do anything, and they were just because of their race, they're stupid, and they're worthless. He said, look, this is not true at all. And Eugene Genovese would back that up with Roll Jordan Roll. But what they would also show in doing this through the evidence is that, well, you know, all these abolitionist attacks on slavery, they're a little far-fetched at times. You can't really find evidence of these things that these abolitionists are talking about. In other words, abolitionists were lying. So what Fogel and Engerman tried to do is say, well, the evidence points in that direction, but there's got to be something more to this. We've got to apologize for slavery because we don't want to be seen as pro-slavery. That says, as Devaney says, that says more about modern America than it does about American history. Because no one would think, just because you're pointing out what slavery was, that you're pro-slavery. No one would think that. No one would think that, well, I mean, nobody should think that with a brain. But I point back to when I purchased those books. I've said it before. I purchased a couple of used copies of those books. And in one, there was an enclosed bunch of papers from the previous owner. And it was from a Liberty Fund conference on slavery. And people would walk up to Fogel and Engerman. They would and say, why are you being pro-slavery? And they would say, we're not. In fact, they went out of their way in the book to say, we're not. Slavery was terrible. Slavery was this. I mean, they had all these things. And so this is where we are. And it's all caused by Kenneth Stamp. Kenneth Stamp decided in the 1940s he was going to start writing histories that didn't say slavery was a dying institution, that that it was this benign institution. It was horrible. So what he did is resurrect the abolitionist attacks on it and made those the primary focus of his book. Well, but he never verified whether these abolitionist attacks were true or not. So what you have is a polemic. Kenneth Stamp's work is a polemic against Craven and Randall and a polemic against what he considers to be false history, even though these abolitionist attacks were often based on rumors without any evidence. Nehemiah Adams, I bring this up. Nehemiah Adams went to the South, and he was an abolitionist. He wanted to find all this bad stuff in the South. So he said, I'm going to travel to the South, and I'm going to go down there, and I'm going to find all this bad stuff, and I'm going to write about it, and I'm going to change the way. I mean, I'm going to prove what we're all saying about the South is true. He goes to the South, and he comes back, and he writes a book that the abolitionists hate, because essentially he says, look, I went down there. I can't find any of this stuff that we're talking about. I don't know what we're talking about here. This isn't what we said it was. That's not to excuse it, okay? Nobody wants slavery in the 21st century. It's not to excuse it. But I think in terms of healing, this is what Fogel and Engerman were trying to do, is heal. This is what the objective was, is trying to heal. It's based on the fact that, okay, we have a wrong impression about Black Americans in the South. They weren't lazy. They weren't unproductive. They weren't stupid. They weren't any of that. They were important contributors to the Southern economy and Southern society, because many of them, free Blacks and also skilled tradesmen, were helping build the South, okay? This is true. So, and the evidence doesn't show that these people were brutal Nazis in the South. And I think this is where, post-World War II, you get that with Stamp and others. I mean, we just fought the Nazis. We don't want Nazis here in America. We don't want to be promoting Nazis in America. And that's how they started thinking of Southerners, antebellum Southerners. So what they're saying is this isn't true. These people weren't these barbarians. Sure, you could find it. Even Genovese says it. Yeah, you could find some of this stuff. But by the 1850s, it's almost gone. There's no evidence of it whatsoever. So Genovese, the Marxist, when he wrote Roll Jordan Roll, he had not converted to Catholicism yet. He had not become more conservative in his life. He was still a Marxist, right? Genovese the Marxist is saying, you know, yeah, there's some bad things that happened in the South, but most of this is hearsay, unverifiable, and we can't prove any of it. And so we can't say it's true. This is what the South was. So all of this is in the spirit of reconciliation, of actually having a real racial reconciliation and healing. But you can't do that if you're basing your work on W.B. Du Bois, who was a rabble-rouser. This is Du Bois is the entire point of the 1619 Project. Du Bois is the entire focus of Eric Foner. And this is what John DeBangey is doing. So when you take that, and then you look at the pieces we published by Clyde Wilson the last couple of weeks in this multi-part series on American slavery, and he talks about all of these misconceptions. You know, this week, it was a nice piece about emancipation, the complexity of emancipation, and what it really was and what the North really wanted out of that, which was simply to bottle up the former slaves in the South and use them as political pawns. It shows they weren't humanitarian in their concerns because we've seen through evidence, nice books on this, a book's been written on this, how slaves were essentially exterminated by the Union during this period of time. We have Paul Graham's excellent book on when the Union Army moved through the Carolinas, when the Yankees come, and all the evidence from the slave narrative projects that were written in the 1930s during the Great Depression, when you were interviewing former slaves and talking about, well, I mean, yeah, we saw that when the Yankees came through, they stole everything. They abused people. They killed people. They were awful. And these are the liberators, right? These are the people that are supposed to be here to help us, and this is what they're doing. So we have that wonderful piece. And of course, last week it was a war to free the slaves. No, it wasn't a war to free the slaves. And of course, as Clyde points out in these two pieces, this is all because of the modern interpretation of the war, which is based entirely on Kenneth Stamp. If you go out, Kenneth Stamp died just a few years ago. And of course, he was in his 90s. And you look at some of the obituaries and eulogies about Kenneth Stamp. This is the most important historian. He changed the way we thought about slavery. He changed the way we thought about America. Kenneth Stamp made a lot of this stuff up. When I say he made it up, I'm not saying he didn't find sources for these things, but he didn't really check it to ensure that this was actually true. He's using the abolitionist sources as a basis for his study of America. And when Tom Fleming, not Tom Fleming at Chronicle, former Chronicles, but Tom Fleming, the historian who died just a few years ago, wrote a book about the war that basically blamed the abolitionists for the war, he was directly attacking Kenneth Stamp. He was saying, look, these people were rabble-rousers, they were the true leftists, they were awful. And Fleming's book, I mean, you go out and read the reviews of that, it's hilarious. People were really upset about this. All these little lefties that run around, and all these little neo-abolitionists, they were upset about this book that Tom Fleming wrote because, oh my gosh, I couldn't imagine that somebody would write this today, that they would say the abolitionists were a problem. And Fleming was not, I mean, he's not pro-Southern. He's looking at the evidence and saying, well, this is the problem. These people were problematic. That's the word the historians often like to use today, problematic. So when you look at American history, and this is exactly what the Abbeville Institute is here to do, to correct this deviation from what Americans understood American history was from the last 70, 80 years. And of course, it's only picked up steam with wokeism, right? And so that's this piece that we had by Bo Trawick last week on Phil Lee's new book on critical race theory. And the title of that book is The Dreadful Frauds. So Bo Trawick wrote a really nice review of this. And that idea, again, 1619 Project, woke history, the effort to change the way we're thinking about America and race and putting one people at the center of the experience and others not there. I mean, this is what I think that Lee is trying to correct. He does a very good job of this. If you don't follow his YouTube channel, he's got a YouTube channel. He talks about these things. He's got an email list. And we publish some of his material here and there. But this book, of course, fantastic in going after these things. And then there's the piece we ran on Monday of this week, the 1862 Louisiana Native Guard. Now, let me say this. The image we used, I use it as an illustration, not to prove that was, in fact, the Native Guard. It's just an illustration of it. Well, I know that particular image is fake, but this is part of the piece, okay? Because what we have in this particular argument is a position that the 1861 Louisiana Native Guard, which was, if you don't know the story, there were free blacks in Louisiana. In fact, New Orleans had a very large free black population, many of whom were slave owners. So in 1861, when the war begins, they organize a Native Guard or a home guard unit. They weren't going to go out and be part of the frontline soldiers, so to speak, right? But they were going to form a militia unit to defend New Orleans. And you had this also in Charleston, South Carolina. There was some talk about, you know, free black Charlestonians signing up. That was blocked. I mean, so we know that race is involved here. But in this particular case, this is interesting because the Native Guard is formed. They drill. And then in 1862, the state of Louisiana passes a bill that reorganizes the militia. And in that bill, it says that you can only be in the militia if you're a free white man. And so people like Kevin Levin, who's written a book on the title is Searching for Black Confederates, and it's the most persistent myth in his mind. There's no black Confederates. They don't exist. And of course, what his position is that the term soldier, nobody ever recognized these people as soldiers because they said these people don't exist. But Confederates doesn't necessarily mean soldiers. But also, if you're going to go that very narrow definition, and if you read his book, it's just a bunch of garbage. Because he basically admits, well, black Confederate soldiers existed, but because the Confederate government didn't call them soldiers, they're not soldiers. You see, this is his argument. That's his argument. It's so stupid, it shouldn't even made it out of the draft stage. In fact, if Kevin Levin was one of my students, and he doesn't have a PhD, theoretically, he could be. I would have sent that back to him and said, work harder because your book is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. You haven't done any real research. Your positions, you're not even following the evidence here. Your positions are stupid. But anyways, so what Shane Anderson does in this particular piece is, okay, well, let's look at this. You've got people like Levin saying, well, the reason, and then after that law is passed, the Native Guard disbands. So and Levin writes about this. Well, it's because we had these people that formed a militia unit, but they weren't really soldiers because the Confederate government didn't recognize them as soldiers. However, they are drilling as a militia unit. But they're not really soldiers. And then when the state of Louisiana passes this law and says that because you're black, you can't be in the militia anymore, they're disbanded, but only called back later because They needed them. Well, and of course, they later signed up and supported the union. Well, I mean, they're going to support the occupiers at that point because they want to just get along. This is what a lot of people do, okay? That's not unusual, all right? But here's the thing. They never disbanded. In fact, what Shane Anderson goes out and says is, look, well, what was the original militia law in Louisiana? It was passed in the 1850s, and it was the same exact language. So if race was a problem, these people shouldn't even have formed in 1861. And you know what? They didn't disband. The very next day, all the militia companies of Louisiana disbanded, and then they reformed. So did the Native Guard. All he did was go out and look at the evidence that's there, something that people like Kevin Levin don't do. Why? Because, number one, they're lazy. Number two, they're new abolitionists who don't care. They just want to find the stuff that fits their agenda. And if it doesn't fit their agenda, they just don't care. They don't care to look for it because they can have drive-bys. They can drive by here, spray a bunch of crap out there that doesn't make any sense and it's not based on anything. But because it's woke and it fits with the modern agenda, it's going to get published. And so Levin's biggest thing is that, oh, this is a peer-reviewed book, University of North Carolina Press. Yeah, from a bunch of people that don't know what they're talking about. And the book is, I mean, the book, again, the book is not very good. It doesn't really have much primary research in it at all. He's quoted in this secondary source or that secondary source. So this is what I like about all of these things. They all work together based on John Devaney's piece. Now, the South, okay, the South and what's happened with the South over the years and what this has done, this new abolitionist, this very Lincolnian America, what this has done is transformed American foreign policy, American domestic policy. It's transformed the way we think about American economics. And so you have a little piece by Donnie Kennedy on March 23rd, Lincoln, Putin, and Yankee Hypocrisy. He talks about how we have this view of foreign policy now that's based exclusively on a Lincolnian myth. And here in this case, the establishment has condemned Putin while at the same time praising Lincoln. And Lincoln did the exact same thing Putin is doing. Look, there are some caveats to this, right? So the areas of Ukraine that wanted to be part of Russia should have been allowed to break away and go to Russia. Now, of course, that would be economically bad for Ukraine, which is why they don't want them to have him do it. But we also know that the Ukrainian government is a puppet government of the United States. It was put in there by the United States. But all this goes back to this position of the North and what we're willing to accept in war crimes. If Putin's a war criminal, so was Lincoln. And as he says at the end of the piece, as declared at the beginning of this article, the assessing of guilt or innocence for the belligerents in the Ukrainian war is not the object of this article. We do take note of the fact that the truth is always a victim in war. For Americans in general, and Southerners in particular, the rank hypocrisy of the Yankee Empire, not only its war upon the South, but as it relates to what General Lee referred to as aggressive abroad foreign policy, is worth studying and understanding. He says, the political establishment and the media continue to denounce Putin while heaping praise upon America's number one tyrant, Lincoln. This is true, right? So if we're going to be pro-Lincoln, then how could you be against Putin? Well, you couldn't if you want to be ideologically consistent. But of course, we're not. Because we have boogeymen and other things. And the end of the day, it's not to support either side in this particular situation. And I know we have people out there that are very passionate about this now, but you have to be careful with these things. And so, historically, Putin is acting more like Lincoln than anybody else in American history. So if we're going to be Lincolnian, well, then you should be on the side of Putin, which, of course, is not a good idea. But this is what we're talking about. So, and then how did this affect American economy? You have this piece by Casey Chalk on Friday of this week, Till Hazel's Virginia, and talking about the change in Northern Virginia, Tyson's Corner, Northern Virginia, and how Till Hazel was the one who really did that. And as Casey says, as I must confess, as a lifelong resident of Northern Virginia, I have mixed feelings about Mr. Hazel and the broader social and economic trends his life represents. I cannot imagine a life apart from one that he helped create. I was baptized at a Catholic parish in Burke, and two of my children were born in Fair Lakes. Yet the things I love most about my native Northern Virginia are the things Hazel most adamantly sought to destroy in his attempts to fashion a new identity for the region. Growing up in one of the last rural parts of Fairfax County, our house was still in walking distance to multiple working farms. Also gone is the Southern culture. The folks across the street who had grown up in Alexandria in the 1950s had thick Virginia accents. Good luck finding such draws there now. A Southern-style restaurant in Old Town Fairfax called Black Eyed Pea is now an Irish pub. Farms that dotted the drive out leave Jackson Memorial Highway to my uncle's 15-acre lot in Unison are now uninspiring subdivisions and made-up towns like Southern Riding, which didn't exist until 1995, and are as soul-crushing as they are boring and ugly. My elementary school, which was within sight of the old St. Mary's Catholic Church where Clara Barton did her first nursing, was one of the oldest schools in Fairfax County, built in 1899. It was originally a frame one-room building. Several of my teachers had thick Virginia accents, and I remember one of them describing what the area had been like before Hazel and Company had begun major development in the area in the 70s and 80s. Now the school's webpage is not only in English, but Spanish, Vietnamese, Korean, Chinese, Arabic, and Farsi, reflecting the reality that American assimilation has been replaced by an obstinate multiculturalism and tribalism that is antithetical to Republican government. He says, but what it lost, ironically, was an identity. The most common complaints I hear about Northern Virginia are either the traffic or its transient nature. Few people are actually from here. Every year, thousands move to Northern Virginia for government or contractor jobs. And every year, thousands more depart for other states or countries. If you actually want to retire in Northern Virginia, and still fewer still, would actually say it possesses a cultural identity worth preserving. It is less a somewhere than it is a land of nowheres. He says, I think that's a real shame. Hazel was a bona fide Southern gentleman with the roots to prove it. Yet he sold out his kin for development and money. Lots of it. He made his home into one of the wealthiest and most influential regions of the United States, and in the process made it indistinguishable from every other zip, super zip in the country. Burke, Virginia doesn't look at all that different from Potomac, Maryland, or California, or New Jersey. Suburban America, for all its affluence, it's sad and soulless, a place its children escape in search of something more meaningful and grounded that gives them a sense of home. I think many Americans, whatever their race, ethnicity, or creed, yearn for a place where they can plant their flag, where they can say to their children, I'm proud of this, and I want you to inherit it and love it as your own. Sadly, there are a diminishingly few number of places that fit that description. I'm working to preserve my little slice of Northern Virginia, which I hope to bequeath to my five children, but it's an uphill demoralizing battle. The materialistic part of me tells me to be grateful to people like Till Hazel for spacious subdivisions and strip malls with ethnic restaurants. But the southern part of me wishes he had just left well enough alone. Beautiful piece, and it exemplifies what's happening in America across the South. This is why we exist, why we publish things like Brandon Meek's The Beer Thief, which is a great little story, Southern history, you know, Southern little Southern story, and about how Merle Haggard stole some beer at a concert, and that was his mom's beer. It's pretty funny. That's truly Southern, and keeping that stuff. This is, you know, Don Livingston and I had a conversation about this. They can do whatever they want. As long as we can sing the songs and we can keep these things going, we'll still be okay. But that's why the Institute exists. So if you like what we do, again, consider a tax-deductible donation to the Institute. It's important. We are the only organization standing in the breach at this point and trying to hold back the flood, and it's really tough. We had a lot of great stuff these last 2 weeks. Good to be back on track. Until next time, good day.